Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, politicians, lobbyists, Hollywood stars, and media personalities converged in Washington for the 2014 White House Correspondents' Dinner. Much of the media coverage focused on celebrities mingling with politicians and talking heads, and lavish pre- and post-parties hosted by Google, Facebook, Yahoo, Wall Street, and lobbyists. But what was missing from the coverage is how this event depicts the dominant political culture in Washington, D.C., which, according to today's guest, Mark Leibovich, is just part of the disconnect between the self-celebration of Washington and the revulsion that people outside of it feel for the major institutions, and the disconnect between incredible prosperity and wealth and decadence that has grown up in Washington in the last couple of decades, and the very real economic struggles that the country has had in the last 6 years. In his new book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital, Mark Leibovich meticulously unpacks Washington's power dynamics and the relationship between members of the media and the political elite and those who dream of joining them. Mark Leibovich is chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. Before joining the Times in 2006, he spent 9 years working for the Washington Post. He's lived in this town for 16 years, and he joins me here in studio. Hi, Mark. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So as a political junkie, I loved your book. Thanks. And I want to ask you first, you've lived in Washington for 16 years. Why did you decide to write this book? Because no one is spared in this book.
Right.
A lot of it is pretty snarky. Everybody has asked you if you've lost friends. But
right.
did something trigger this?
I think if I had to answer that honestly, I would say that unconsciously, I wanted to check myself before I became too much a part of this club. I do think that if you're a journalist, you should have some kind of sixth sense at a certain point that should trigger a need to be uncomfortable, a need to make people uncomfortable. And one of the things about Washington, especially Washington journalism, is that it's an incredibly comfortable pursuit if you want it to be. There are a lot of good and hardworking journalists there, obviously. But you can do very, very, very well just basically by watching, you know, just sort of looking right into the mirror not looking into the mirror in the sort of look at yourself sort of way, but by looking at the dynamic of the world you're in and by going to parties and by, like, you know, having things spoon-fed to you, stories and so forth. And I think that, you know, I wanted to, I guess, on some level, shake things up.
The one message that I walked away with is that while what politicians love to say that there's gridlock, there's partisanship, there's no possible way we can find common ground on these issues,
right,
they find a lot of common ground when it comes to money. I mean, what I
right.
loved is that you show how one day a politician will say that he hates lobbyists and the next day he leaves D.C. and goes to work for Boeing or General Electric. And
yeah.
it doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or a Republican.
No, exactly. I mean, the cliche is almost, you know, there's no Democrats, Republicans, only millionaires. And it's true. I mean, the notion that this is this big, hopelessly divided world is, in fact, it's a misnomer, because the fighting you see on TV, the yelling on cable, the blogs, the on the floors of Congress. I mean, if you go into the green rooms, the gray sort of demilitarized zone of the green room, I mean, these are people who during commercials or before going on the air are going to business together, whether to open a restaurant or go into a lobbying firm or to just, you know, do whatever. And there's just so much money in Washington now. That is, I guess, the real water's edge of this divide we see.
And while a lot of this is funny and a lot of it kind of makes you roll your eyes, a lot of it's really tragic and depressing, because real issues are at stake here. And
right.
what these people do really do affect people's lives.
Yeah, no, I mean, the core of this book is disconnect. I mean, it's about disconnect, it's about arrogance, and it's about just the insularity that grows up when you have this bubble of, basically a bubble of power, but also in the last couple of decades, this bubble of incredible wealth, this bubble of incredible sort of self, I guess, sort of self-absorption that's been exacerbated by the internet. And I think that the alleged democratization of new media on this process has actually had kind of an opposite effect, in that the clubbiness has now moved online. And it's still very, very insulated and actually does ignore the bigger problems of the country.
You say that a couple of decades ago, a lot of people wanted to go to D.C. to really make a difference and change things for the better.
Right.
And now most people want to go there for power and money. When did the political culture start to shift?
You know, I think there were a couple of tipping points. I mean, one, first of all, I mean, there are still certainly people who go to Washington to make a difference. And I think power has always been an appeal of Washington. I mean, I think the thing that really is different now is money. I mean, three decades ago, I mean, maybe in the early 90s, I mean, the Clinton years were a real sort of, beginning of the symbiosis between Wall Street and Washington. I mean, you had people going back and forth. I mean, Rahm Emanuel was the political director for the White House. He left in, you know, sometime in the mid-90s, went to Wasserstein Perella, which is a banker. He made about $18.6 million, maybe $18.8 million in 2 years to do, you know, he doesn't have any banking experience. He was known as a relationship banker. And essentially, he was bringing in clients. He was schmoozing. He was doing what politicians or former politicians do. And then Rahm went back to run for Congress, which was, I guess, you know, now that he was enriched to that degree, he was giving back. But I do think that I would say, you know, the early Clinton years, Bob Rubin was sort of a seminal figure moving from Wall Street to D.C. He kind of, you know, greased the pipeline quite a bit.
In the Clinton years, I mean, the Democrats were not known for taking a lot of money from Wall Street at that time.
Right.
But Bill Clinton said, wait a minute, if we're going to win elections, we need a lot of money. And so that's when it all started.
Yeah, no, I mean, campaign finance, I mean, people focus on, you know, really the probably illegal, you know, campaign finance stuff that went on during the Clinton years that a lot of the Clinton people were embroiled in. But in fact, yeah, I mean, they were playing by the rules that existed at the time, which is just to raise big money from big, you know, financial interests. And they really did sort of become, you know, they were really the pioneers of that, if you could call it that. But, and they won elections.
You also say that those of us who don't trust politicians really don't know how deep... Well, do you call it corruption? How deep the corruption is? How deep, maybe how they really are in bed with each other? And out here in the Bay Area, Northern California, we're really disconnected from this.
Yes, I mean it's amazing how. First of all, when I talk about this book, I mean the reaction inside of Washington has focused on, ooh, he really names names. I mean, who wins? Who loses? I mean, what's the gossip?
A lot of it's also tongue-in-cheek, the coverage of this.
A lot of it is. It's like, hey, look at us. We've been named. We haven't been named. I mean, it's all a game. Once you get outside, there's a really, I think, healthy but also kind of palpable sense of both disgust and entertainment. I mean, it's a fun book. I hope people want to read it. But I do think that, yeah, no, I mean, and that's actually been the most hopeful thing that I've taken from this, which is that people really do care. Mm-hmm. I mean, this has not been met with a paralysis. I mean, I think there's a distinction between paralysis and despair. And I think that I seem to be on the right side of it, at least in how people have reacted to it. So that gives me hope.
Yeah. What was it like for you? Because your book came out in hardcover last year. Now it's out in paperback.
Right.
And you've traveled around the country talking about this. And you have this section in your paperback edition saying that the biggest surprise you encountered was the biggest source of hope. What was it like for you as sort of an insider to leave the bubble and go talk to people about these issues?
You know, surprisingly, but really wonderfully refreshing. I mean, it's been... I've always said that the best part of being a Washington insider and covering Washington is the ability to leave periodically because, my job enables me to do that. But this has been an eye-opener for me because, in a way, I've been feeling more sort of activist than any time since college.
Hmm.
And, you know, as a journalist, you're supposed to check your political activism and you have no opinions. And certainly you need some detachment and a lot of skepticism. And that's come pretty naturally to me because, you know, the more politicians you get to know, especially in Washington, the easier it is to sort of lose some of the idealism that you might have when you're young. But again, I guess it's been great. I've loved talking to some of the people I've met. I mean, I have a greater appreciation for just outside of Washington-ness. And that's on both sides. I mean, it's been conservatives, it's been liberals, it's been across the spectrum.
Is it easy to get consumed with this culture when you live there?
Oh, totally.
And not realize that there's a big disconnect? Because what I find fascinating is when you look at the percentage of people who want a higher minimum wage, who completely disagree with Citizens United, who believe that Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. It's like 70-80%, the highest percentage in history.
Right.
Yet we don't see that play out in Washington.
We don't. And frankly, I mean, a lot of the interests outside of Washington that are fighting against this are very, very well funded. I mean, you know, the Koch brothers aren't in Washington. I mean, Sheldon Adelson isn't in Washington. A lot of self-interest, goes a long way. And You know, a lot of it's follow the money. And unfortunately, the current environment is such that the money flows pretty directly, you know, from these, you know, central sources to D.C. But I do look, I mean, but again, that's another form of the disconnect we're talking about. And it's just you do see it play out pretty dramatically.
What about the well-established members of the media? I mean, a lot of them are married to politicians. I mean, there's so much intermingling going on there.
Yeah.
And they love to be seen with a lot of these politicians. You write about this. They take photos. They're so excited to meet politicians.
Right.
What role are they playing in all of this? Because why is it that people are ill-informed with so much information out there?
I think one of the messages of this town that, again, this wasn't intentional as I was writing it, but it's the co-option. I mean, I don't think these are bad people per se. I mean, when people are commingling, sure, you know, you're going to get married, you're going to become friends, you're going to go into business together. I mean, it's only natural. I think, though, that, I mean, there's a, I'm going to botch this, but I quote it in the beginning of the book. I mean, people say, essentially the message is the fish are always the last to discover the water. I mean, I've known a lot of journalists over the years who have sort of woken up at a certain point. It's like, hey, wow, I'm part of this. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with a politician marrying a journalist. I mean, people fall in love, right? But, again, I think periodically you need to throw yourself out of the water and go into like some scalding hot water or cold water and just sort of realize that this is not the world you're serving. You are not talking to the same. I mean, you might be talking to the same 20 people every day, but you're hopefully serving a broader purpose and a broader audience.
I'm speaking with Mark Leibovich, chief national correspondent with the New York Times Magazine, and his new book is This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral in America's Gilded Capital. When you talk about the disconnect, Mark, there's so many stories in this book. Which one do you think illustrates this the most, especially when you look at a politician on Monday saying that he, and I'm using mostly he because the book is fairly male-dominated.
Let's go with he.
But yeah. I do want you to talk about people like Anita Dunn.
Mm-hmm.
I hate lobbyists, and the next day they go work for General Electric and Boeing.
Right.
You really illustrate BP, for example, and the lobbyists that they hired. But which one do you think illustrates this the best?
Oh,
what
boy.
Shocked you when you did
so
this
many
research?
Of them. I mean, very little after a while. I mean, I guess, you know, Chris Dodd, who was a very, you know, accomplished Democratic senator for many years from Connecticut. He was retiring in 2010. He had this really great sort of legislative kind of grand finale. I mean, he was right in the middle of the health care bill. He was right in the middle of Dodd-Frank. I mean, he was keen, you know, his committees were right there. He was extremely unpopular in Connecticut. He had a scandal involving Countrywide, the mortgage. You know, he was accused of getting favorable treatment from them. I remember writing a story about him as he was leaving and having lunch with him and saying, okay, Senator, well, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, you have this whole brave new world ahead of you. And he was so excited. I mean, he had been talked about as the possible next president of the University of Connecticut. He talked about joining the Peace Corps, which is what he had done earlier in his career. He talked about coming out to Silicon Valley, starting a company or joining a startup or something. And, you know, it was just as he got out of the Senate, you could just sort of see the coloring in his face kind of disappear. And you know, I asked him, are you going to lobby? He said, no, absolutely not. And, you know how this story ends. You know, he's now head of the Motion Pictures Association of the United States, which is one of the most powerful lobbying groups in town. He's making, I guess, like $3 million a year. And, look, he's allowed to lie. He's allowed to change his mind. He's allowed to make a living. And, like, I guess I don't fault him for that, but I guess I'm allowed to be a little more cynical after that happens.
What has he done in that position?
I don't know. I guess he's had some parties. I haven't talked to him since the book came out, but what was interesting is about 2 years later, Joe Lieberman, his quasi-Democratic colleague from Connecticut, was retiring also. And I said, so, Senator, what are you going to do? And he said, well, I'll tell you what I'm not going to do. I'm not going to lobby. I said, you know, I've not heard a Democratic senator from Connecticut so sure of himself since Chris Dodd told me the exact same thing 2 years ago. And he said, yeah, I know, but watch me. And I can tell you the ending to this story, too. He is apparently, according to Politico, a couple months ago, he signed on to lobby for some politician in Libya. And so he is now officially a lobbyist. He joined the private equity sector, as many people do. But at least, you know, some of these people, when they join private equity, are praised for not going right into banks. So that's good.
This is kind of an amazing stat you write in your book. The Atlantic has also reported on this. In 1974, 3% of retiring members of Congress became lobbyists. Now 50% of senators and 42% of congressmen do.
That's, you know, it's funny. People pick up on that statistic more than almost any other in the book. And it's amazing. And it does give you a great window into certainly the revolving door, but also it makes you wonder, I mean, who are these people working for when they're in office? And there was a telling moment. I was actually talking to Jack Abramoff, the disgraced lobbyist who went to jail for about, you know, 3-4 years. And he was talking about how he would get to know these staff people on the Hill and these Congress people. And he would say, after a while, I'd say, hey, you should think about coming to work for us one day. And then he sort of stepped back and said, I knew that when we had that conversation, I owned them. Because there was this implicit, you know, sort of a preemptive bribe there, which is, if you keep this relationship up, if you continue to please me as a lobbyist, there will be a seven-figure job waiting for you on the other end. And that's, again, it begs the question, who are they working for?
Is there any difference between the Democrats and Republicans when it comes to leaving D.C. to work for a lobbyist or to become a lobbyist?
No, not really. I mean, I think if there's one difference, I mean, Republicans don't seem as embarrassed as Democrats do. I mean, Republicans, you know, are perfectly at home saying, oh, yeah, you know, I'll take whatever I can get. I mean, John Breaux is a Democrat, and he had this famous line where, you know, people say I can be bought. People say I can be rented. No, he said, I'm totally botched. He said, people say, John Breaux, you can be bought. I said, I can't be bought, but I can be rented. And then someone else called him a cheap whore, and he says, you know, I'm not that cheap. So anyway.
What about Jack Quinn and Ed Gillespie? You write about them in your book. The Democratic lobbyist Jack Quinn paired up with Republican Ed Gillespie, a political strategist. They founded Quinn, Gillespie and Associates, a bipartisan lobbying firm. So, you know, all kinds of people can come to them, including BP. Mm-hmm. And then Ed Gillespie is now running for Senate in Virginia. They sold their firm for $40 million.
They did.
I mean, how does this thing sell for so much money?
Well, I mean, they have a lot of clients. I mean, you know, there are these big sort of holding firms. I mean, a lot of them are based overseas, that they see these Washington firms with all these clients, and there's money. I mean, there's a lot of money to be made in lobbying, and there's a great deal of money to be made by corporations. I mean, you'd think, what are they paying all these lobbyists for? I mean, you know, we're talking, you know, millions of dollars, but if they can get a decimal point moved a couple of, you know, inches to the right, or to the, you know, in the bill that the lobbyists have written that they're trying to influence, I mean, that's billions of dollars for their bottom line. So it all works out.
And the corporation's return is huge.
Huge.
Because
absolutely
huge. It's actually kind of, when you look at how much money corporations make, they're mm-hmm. spending pennies on lobbying, right?
They're spending, yeah.
Sometimes it's like $30,000, $40,000 to a politician.
Yes, although the pennies we're talking about are millions, in fact. But no, it's true. It is absolutely true. And look, on the face of it, it looks like a big waste of money. I mean, they're buying me lunch, okay?
Right.
They're billing someone, you know, probably thousands of dollars to have lunch with me. I'm just a guy they're having lunch with. But in fact, no, I'm a journalist that they think they're influencing or that they're trying to influence. And, you know, I'm not allowed to let them buy me lunch, but we're having lunch and they're, you know, they're getting paid a lot more than I am for getting lunch with them.
So given the realities that we're facing right now and the McCutcheon Supreme Court ruling mm-hmm. is going to make money and is going to basically put even more money in politics, right?
Right?
The next election is going to be more expensive than the last one.
It's amazing.
So do you think the average person can have faith in Washington, or do you believe that everything and everyone is for sale?
I would say that the average person, I wouldn't say, I think faith is too strong a word. I mean, I think faith has been shaken. I mean, I do have a belief in the grassroots. I have a belief, and this is going to sound way too politician-like, but I do believe in America's ability to force change on itself, sometimes after great kicking and screaming and disgrace and waste and scandal and everything that, you know, has gone on. I do think that the Obama 08 campaign, or even the Tea Party campaigns, I mean, are emblematic of this outsider power. And if there's one thing, I mean, so, and I also believe, look, I think if the right candidate came along and actually ran on campaign finance or actually made this a centerpiece of their message in the way that, you know, John McCain did in 2000, Barack Obama did to a point in 2007 and 2008.
John Edwards did.
John Edwards,
talked a lot about lobbyists and the poor.
He did. Now, look, and then he became a equity guy. John Edwards is a whole other story.
We won't go past that. But, yeah, I mean, yes. But look at how much attention he got from average people because he talked about these issues.
Absolutely. Now, populism is extremely important and powerful force in American politics. But obviously it also opens its... I mean, people can leverage that. There are opportunists everywhere who can become populists.
Well, what do you think of Senator Elizabeth Warren, for example? Because she definitely has the populist message on economics, talking about student debt. I mean, she's... What are your thoughts on her message?
It's funny. I'm asked more about Elizabeth Warren in the last few months, especially, than any other single politician.
Well, because she's out with a new book.
The new book. I mean, you know, she's a fascinating character. I mean, look, as a journalist, as someone who loves a good argument and a good campaign, I would love to see her run for president because I think she would be in the middle and I think she would occasion a really important argument, especially within the Democratic Party. But, I mean, her credentials are fascinating. I mean, she really, I think, has fought the good fight. I hope she runs. Because I think it would be a fascinating debate. And I'm just not in the mood, again, as a journalist, to sort of see a Clinton coronation within the Democratic Party. So, I'm completely neutral, but I would love to see the story play out.
Do you think someone like Elizabeth Warren can change things in Washington?
Yeah.
And what would it take?
It would take her to get elected to a higher office. I mean, but as a senator, as a U.S. senator from Massachusetts, I mean, she can do a lot. I mean, she hasn't done that much. I mean, she hasn't made that much of a mark in the Senate. I mean, this book is really the first kind of big rollout of her becoming more outspoken. I'm hoping it signals more so because I think that's what got her elected, to begin with. And I think there's an incredible appetite for it. I do think the Democratic Party has a pretty shallow bench as far as certainly on the liberal side or on the non-Clinton side, because you don't – I mean, you hear the name, Bernie Sanders kicked around. You hear, maybe Martin O'Malley. I don't see them catching on and capturing the imagination of the larger sector that maybe Elizabeth Warren could. So,
and before we go to break, can you name a few politicians that don't – that would not – I mean, a lot of politicians are not named in your book,
right,
but politicians that are not for sale?
I'm asked that a lot. I need a better answer. I mean, I'm a big fan of let me adjust the not for sale construction. I mean, that implies that every single problem. I mean, look, it's gray. A lot of people are sort of for sale and for not. I mean, Tom Coburn, who's a very conservative, Republican from Oklahoma, I think, is pretty, doesn't really care. I think. Oh boy!
He talks about waste a lot. That's his thing.
He talks a lot about waste. He talks a lot about waste. I mean, Harry Reid is a weird. Has been seen as a weird hero for the book. He certainly deals with a lot of lobbyists, and he's a very old school politician. But I think on some level he doesn't. He has some integrity that I think comes out in the book. That's a bad answer. I need to think of a better one.
Well, you can think about it during the break.
Anyone not named.
Mark Leibovich is chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, and his new book is This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral in America's Gilded Capital. We'll be back after this.
And you're listening to Your Call as part of the Public Radio Party here on KALW San Francisco, where we're celebrating the fact that in this country, we got public radio that has a group of decentralized independent stations that get to make their own support. I'm Matt Martin, station manager here with Joe Burke. And when you hear how Washington is these days, you're kind of glad we don't have public radio run from D.C. We have it here locally based, kept support by people in the community.
That's right. You're the folks who help make KALW happen day in and day out. It's your contributions that keep this community resource strong. I wanted to say good morning and thank you to Scott Carroll of Berkeley, who joined the public radio this morning. Also, Ingrid Hanbridge of Albany, who loves Rose Aguilar, and Janet Basu of San Francisco, another fan of your Call.
And so we are looking in this hour for 20 people to support local public radio. Join people like Ann Smith in Oakland, who went online to KALW.org and gave her support this hour. If we make it to 20 calls or clicks, 20 contributions to local public radio, it's an additional $365 for local
public
radio.
Tell them about our thank you gift that we have only during this hour of today's Your Call.
That's right. That's Mark Leibovich's book, This Town, yours for a $120 contribution. You're hearing a few of the stories, some of Mark's reflections during this hour with Rose Aguilar, but there's a reason why it's a bestseller. It has a lot in it that you'll want to know about. Your support of $120 will get you this book as our thanks.
And you call and make that pledge at that pledge level, and you're going to get us just a little bit closer to our goal, which is 20 calls or clicks during today's Your Call, a program that has been growing over the last several years thanks to contributions from listeners like you. Please take this opportunity to support an incredible daily talk show put together by Rose Aguilar and the production team, 800-525-9917.
Listener support keeps this station independent and makes Your Call possible. We thank you for being part of it.
The regular people. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be joined by Nomi Prinz. She's out with a new book called All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. And then on Wednesday, we'll be joined by Julia Angwin. We'll talk about her book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom. She's a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I'm joined by Mark Leibovich, Chief National Correspondent for The New York Times Magazine. Before joining The Times in 2006, he spent 9 years working for The Washington Post. He's lived in Washington for 16 years. And his new book is This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral in America's Gilded Capital. He believes that we are even more disconnected from Washington than we think. He writes a lot about the incredible prosperity and wealth and decadence that has grown up in Washington over the last couple of decades. And he'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at Kepler's in Menlo Park, 1010 El Camino Real. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. So we were talking earlier about maybe some politicians that you respect because they actually, you know, they don't talk about one thing one day and then do the complete opposite the next day. But do you think like a politician like a Dennis Kucinich could make it back to Washington, D.C.?
Well, I mean, he couldn't make it.
Not him, per se, because he lost his last election.
Sure.
Someone like that.
Absolutely. I mean, look, I mean, there are, I think it's easier maybe in a congressional district. It's easier maybe in a small state when actually someone can work and get to know voters on a more intimate level to in a way that actually can transcend what might be the political biases people have. I mean, Bernie Sanders, we mentioned him earlier. I mean, he is – I mean, Vermont's a tiny state, very, very – you know, I think it's one of the smallest population, you know, states in the country. I mean, it certainly is. He is someone who has appealed to gun owners. He is someone who has appealed to, you know, a very conservative strain of Vermonter, you know, because it's seen as a pretty liberal state now, but there's actually a very, very libertarian conservative strain there. And they know him, and he has spoken to them, and they understand him, and many of them disagree very much with him. And you know, he was a congressman. He's been a senator the last few years. And so, look, I mean, it is easier. I mean, someone like Dennis Kucinich, I mean, again, I mean, he was voted out. I mean, he was, and part of it was redistricting. Mm. I do think that Dennis Kucinich, you know, he ran for president twice without, you know, having a chance. So, I mean, in some ways, Dennis Kucinich is a brand.
And the media didn't take him seriously.
The media didn't take him seriously, although, I mean, you know, he was allowed in the debates. Yeah. I mean, you could argue that those campaigns, you know, made him to some degree. I mean, you know, he got book deals out of it. He's making a ton of money for Fox now.
That's right.
So, I mean, look, I mean, he did play that game also. Again, not that there's nothing wrong with it, but he hasn't done a heck of a lot in office. Let's put it that way. You know, he was the mayor of Cleveland in the 70s. Didn't, you know, he was pretty disastrous there. So, anyway, I mean, I don't want to hold up Dennis Kucinich for ridicule or praise in this case, but I do, but no, I mean, Tom Coburn, I mentioned earlier, I mean, has a lot of you know, Democratic supporters because they get to know him and they actually appreciate his integrity on these things.
Mark Leibovich is out with a book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral in America's Gilded Capital. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What do you want to know about what really goes on in Washington? Because Mark believes that even those of us who follow politics very closely don't understand just how immersed people are in Washington, how much money there is, how these backdoor deals actually work. So if you have any questions for Mark, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. So I want to ask you about some of the people you write about. David Plouffe, President Obama's campaign manager, hired, and I also want you to tell us about this guy, hired Bob Barnett to get him a really good book deal. He got a 7-figure advance for his book about the 2008 campaign, The Audacity to Win. You write that David Plouffe earned $1.5 million in 2010, according to White House disclosure statements, which included a portion of the book advance proceeds from consulting for Boeing and General Electric and $500,000 for paid speaking gigs.
Yeah, I mean,
and this is just common, right?
It's extremely common. I mean, what's interesting about David is, I mean, he was basically the father of the Obama 07-08 campaign. I mean, this was about, I mean, he would deride Republicans for just sort of making an easy buck in corporate, you know, being in bed with corporations and stuff. And again, I mean, David is, he did a very effective job at his job as a campaign manager. I mean, they built a historic campaign. And yeah, he's cashing in, and he's, you know, David's pretty unapologetic about it. I think he probably could make a lot more money, so maybe he has a compass, you know, maybe he draws a line, but this is extremely common. I mean, everyone in that position is sort of set for life. I mean, Jim Messina, the campaign manager of the 2012 campaign, probably made, you know, I would say 8-9 figures already, you know, I'm guessing just in paid speeches, consulting, I mean, look, they're cashing in.
If you write about this guy, Bob Barnett, and I didn't know about him before reading this book. I'm sure a lot of people have no idea who he is. And it's what's fascinating about this guy. He's a lawyer, friends with the Clintons, got Hillary Clinton an $8 million book deal, Bill Clinton a $10 million book deal. And he also got Sarah Palin her 8-figure TV and book deals.
Yeah. No, I mean, he Bob, you know, he's just this power broker, kind of lawyer, agent, kind of fixer type in D.C. You know, he refers to himself as the doorman to the revolving door. Basically, Bob's the guy you go to if you want to cash in. And he's, you know, he'll represent Republicans, Democrats. And it's not just big-name politicians doing big book deals. I mean, Bob greases the pipeline from office to lobbying jobs or lobbying jobs to consulting jobs. He represents 375 broadcast people. So the watchdogs are also in the same, you know, under the same umbrella as Bob. And, you know, Bob, I think, I mean, look, he's a kind of single one-stop shopping for cashing in. And, you know, no one knows about a guy like that. And I don't think he likes me very much after reading the book, so that's fine.
Well, you wrote, the degree to which so many elite D.C. players stream to a single super lawyer cash redemption center is striking, even by the parochial standards of the ant colony.
Yeah, exactly. I wrote those words. Yeah.
Why is it important for us to know about someone like a Bob Barnett?
Because he is emblematic of the fact that we are all in this, or many people in Washington are all in the same club. And the same club is dictated by sort of the almighty dollar. And Bob is the conduit to cashing in. And again, he's very, very proud of the fact that he's bipartisan in his ability to make everyone rich. And so, you know, Bob is very, he loves having friends. He loves being able to drop names and, you know, he thinks he's a big counselor to presidents and confidant and thinks he's all discreet and everything. But in fact, he's an institution in his own right.
We talked a little bit about David Plouffe, Obama's former campaign manager. And in your book, you write a lot about how the insiders did get together and talk about how they didn't want this campaign, or they wanted it to be sort of independent from money, and we don't like lobbyists, and lobbyists are not going to call the shots. Remember the change word back then? But when you look at the power that lobbyists have under President Obama, It's massive. I mean, they're breaking records.
Yeah. They've been, you know, lobbying's been alive and well for many, many, many years and under the Obama administration. I mean, part of it is, it's unclear to me how hard they tried. I mean, they've made a lot of exceptions to their no lobbyists in the White House rule, or our administration will not be a home to lobbyists rule. You know, they keep sort of reversing themselves, whether they're, we're not going to deal with super PACs, now they're dealing with super PACs. We're not going to, in 2008, we're not going to opt out of the campaign finance system. They opted out of the campaign finance system when it was clear that they could raise billions of dollars on their own. So the other thing is, though, I mean, they've actually done a lot of legislation. I mean, you know, a lot of big, complicated legislation, like the health care bill and the stimulus bill. That's complicated. When you add complication to the system, lobbyists benefit, because people that understand this, they see lobbyists as the people who can help them navigate these new thickets of rules that can help them make money, and that's great for business.
You also point out that Obama signed an executive order to keep lobbyists out of his administration, but he made exceptions, like former Raytheon lobbyist Bill Lynn was granted a waiver to serve as Deputy Secretary of Defense.
Sure. I mean, yeah, that was early on. I mean, Joe Biden's chief of staff now is a legendary lobbyist, Steve Ricchetti. You know, there's just a ton of examples. I mean, Cecilia Munoz, who is the head of the domestic policy. Chief domestic policy, I guess she has some title like that, in the administration. I mean, she's a lobbyist. I mean, so they made all kinds of exceptions, and that's, you know, that's fine.
Let's hear from a few listeners. Let's go to Jenny in San Francisco. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, what about Sherrod Brown? Sheldon of Ohio, a big state, not a small state. Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. Raul Grijalva of Arizona. I can't imagine that they're becoming lobbyists. I mean, I think there are, I mean, all you could come up with was a right-winger, Tom Coburn. I can't imagine that those three politicians, for example, that I mentioned, you know, I have somewhat faith they went in it for civic duty.
There are many who go in it for civic duty. I mean, I think, though, it's complicated. I mean, first of all, Sherrod Brown, Sheldon Whitehouse, I mean, they're still in office. You know, remains to be seen what they do. You know, a lot of people believe in them. I actually don't really know either of them. I don't think they were in the book. But it is complicated. And I mean, you can't, you know, paint too broad a brush here. So, you know, I take your point. I mean, Tom Coburn, I'm not holding out as the single good person in Washington. I mean, there are a lot of them. And again, it's sometimes in the gray area.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Jenny. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What do you want to know about what really happens in Washington, D.C., the relationships between Democrats and Republicans, the lobbyists, the amount of money? Washington is now the wealthiest metropolitan area in the United States by far.
7 of the 10 wealthiest counties in the United States are in the Washington metropolitan area.
The number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Rose, and hi to your guest.
Hi, Andy.
I wanted to bring up Dennis Kucinich. I just found, like, listening to this show, the media attack on Dennis Kucinich just continued with yourself, Mr. Leibowitz, on this show. Hey, he saved Cleveland from being privatized from the utilities companies. They wanted to come in there and privatize the electric and water, and he stopped that. So that was a major plus for him when he was in Cleveland. And he was one of the only person to go after Bush with the impeachment papers, and would constantly stood up for the American people to try to end that war and stop the war crimes that are consistently going on with our government. He got up there and he put himself on the line. And the media went after him and attacked him with a vengeance I've never seen before. Tim Russert, in particular, made fun of him during those debates concerning the flying saucer episode. And the corporate media has gone after him with a vengeance when he was like the only one sticking up for the working class in this country, period. He was the man for the workers and the working class and the people that have no say. And you went and attacked him yourself. I'm outraged by your comment. I really am. Thank you.
I would say, look, I mean, I can't speak for the entire media, the corporate media, for Tim Russert or anything. I will say, you know, Dennis Kucinich, when he did run for president twice, didn't exactly talk about his record as, you know, mayor of Cleveland, especially, you know, the bankruptcy that he presided over, as something that he was running on. As far as his impeachment proceedings on President Bush, I mean, you know, whether it's the media's fault or not, it didn't get a lot of traction. So, look, Dennis Kucinich is a very important voice to some people. It just, he didn't really, you know, for whatever reason, didn't have the impact that I think that many people wanted it to.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Andy. We have an email from Catherine in Richmond who says, why do some legislators seem to be made of Teflon, as pundits used to say about Ronald Reagan? I think in particular about Dianne Feinstein, whose conflicts of interest have been investigated and confirmed many times, and yet she's untouchable. I'm sure she's not the only one, but she's the one Californians are most affected by.
Well, I mean, I would say this. I mean, first of all, incumbency makes people pretty Teflon. I mean, yes, you're in the arena. You are open to attack. You can be in, you know, there's all kinds of disclosures that are going to make you vulnerable to things. But Dianne Feinstein's been elected many, many, many times. She has, I mean, like most U.S. senators, like certainly like congressmen, you have an incredible advantage, you know, being in office. So, like, Dianne Feinstein is not someone I have covered. I think that she, I don't know, is she going to run again? Is she? She was just where is she in the cycle now? I don't even know. But anyway,
I should know.
Yeah.
Dianne
Feinstein,
know.
If you're listening, we will find out.
But you have, like, Nancy Pelosi doesn't even have to debate anymore.
No, most congressmen don't. Most members of Congress do not have to debate. I mean, that's one of the dirty little secrets. I mean, yes, Congress is completely ineffective. It's under siege. I mean, the dynamic we have now is not so much that you have the Republicans in power are much more afraid of being primaried from the right, which makes them much more beholden to their base and certainly almost impossible to, like, put into a compromising position with the Democrats. So that, I mean, the dynamic right now is either very safe incumbency or terror on the part of the right to be primary.
The Daily Beast reports that Feinstein has hinted that she might not seek re-election in 2018.
There you go. So
she's
here for
least
another 3, 4, or 5 years.
Yeah.
So,
okay. Yeah. All right. Thanks for calling in, or thanks for the email, Catherine. Let's go next to Rod in Oakland. Hi, Rod.
Hi, good morning. First of all, kudos to your guest. It's a terrific, although I've only read it, read the reviews. I've not yet had time to read the complete text. But if I could pose a quick question, two-part. Mm-hmm. You did mention that to paraphrase Churchill, you know, America will eventually do the right thing after all these vicissitudes. What would you predict, or would you guess, what would be the correction? Would it be a constitutional amendment to against People United, or are we going to get something from the right, perhaps another Teddy Roosevelt, something, please?
I think that the nation is very, very ripe for some kind of grassroots movement, whether it's in the form of a third-party candidate, whether it's in the form of some kind of sort of major campaign finance overhaul that gets some really big legislative traction. I mean, if there's one thing I've learned is that Washington does respond to self-interest. If their livelihoods are threatened, you know, they will, kicking and screaming, act. I mean, immigration would not be something that Republicans are even thinking about right now if it weren't going to affect their electoral destiny, you know, going forward. You know, gun control. No one thought that anyone was going to have there was going to be a big gun control debate in the country in early 2013. You know, all of a sudden Newtown happens and you know, Republicans either got scared or were waking up, and, you know, they came pretty close. I mean, it didn't happen, which was, I think, demoralizing to a lot of people. But I think ultimately it got closer, you know, driven by a grassroots event.
Well, and a lot of people said, if we can't get gun control after this horrific event, then we have completely lost our way.
Yeah.
What is it going to take?
I mean, that is another way of looking at it, right? I mean, I hate to say it. I just think that, I hope that never, ever happens again. But the fact is that, like, you know, mass shootings are sort of part of our cultural landscape now, and I don't know, maybe eventually that's how the needle will get moved. Hopefully it won't be.
All right, thank you, Rod. Let's go next to Michael in San Francisco. Hi, Michael.
Oh, hi, Rose. Thank you very much. Always good to hear your program.
Thank you. Go ahead, you're on the air.
The guest His use of language bothers me. The talk about the lawyer, Mr. Barnett, I guess, or Barrett, right or left, or Republican or Democrat, doesn't make any difference. He's bipartisan. I don't like the word bipartisan because it hides from the public the fact that, as Gore Vidal said, we have one party with two right wings. In fact, Mr. Barnett or Barrett is a corporatist, and both parties are the heads of them and the major leaders are corporately linked to moving government along. The people no longer matter. I disagree with your last statement that Washington will move. Dick Durbin a year and a half ago said nothing moves up here unless the banks approve it. So unless we can get public financing, everything you've said, I don't think holds any water. And I would like your comment on the word corporatist and how serious we can get rid of the term bipartisan. How seriously we can get rid of the term bipartisan.
Okay, corporatist. Here's what I would say to the term corporatist. I mean, I do think that corporate interests are extremely powerful in American politics right now. Bob Barnett, whether it's bipartisan, whatever you call it, bipartisan or not, he helps people cash in. I personally don't think that is in the interest of public service necessarily. It's in the interest of self-service. And, the undercurrent of this book is self-service. That's been the transformation of Washington, D.C. over the last few decades. And, I don't know if it's corporatism or just the effect of corporate money, but that's, I think, become the prevailing dynamic.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Michael. Let's go next to Harry in Berkeley. Hi, Harry.
Hi, Ann. Rose, sorry.
It's okay.
The problem is that you need to talk to this about what's the impact on the public. This is so far, it's really interesting. I believe in it. I know this. I've been a lobbyist for many, many years. But what's the impact on public policy? What bills have been affected, and how do they affect the average person? It's one thing to talk about a decimal point being moved from here to there, and I love your reporting, but the next part needs to be so what?
The so what here is, first of all, and the people who can afford lobbyists almost in every case are the people who can afford it. There was a ton of money behind a horse slaughtering business, right? The 99.999% of people who would be appalled by horse slaughtering would be completely outgunned if they were being outspent, 1,000 to 1 by the horse slaughtering lobby that could give to the leadership packs of every congressman who's going to vote for their causes.
Well, you have a real example in here that does talk about how we are affected by this, especially people in the Gulf, and
right.
That's the BP disaster.
Absolutely.
And the team of lobbyists that they hired from the Democratic and the Republican side.
Yeah. And excuse my word, but bipartisan. Yeah, exactly. No, it's true. I mean, when, the Gulf was under siege and, just being this horrific environmental disaster was going on, BP was spending tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars buying up Democratic lobbyists, Republican lobbyists, media consultants, messaging consultants, people who had a direct pipeline, no pun intended, to the White House, to members of Congress. And again, the fishermen in the Gulf were not hiring a lot of lobbyists at that point. They haven't hired a lot of lobbyists in the last 4 or 5 years. And people are going to be affected by that. Pelicans are going to die over that, but it's Pelicans don't have a lobby either, I don't think. But no, it's sort of a great imbalance of who has the interest and who has the money and who has the ears of the people on their side.
Well, and they successfully changed the narrative.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks to tens of millions of dollars in advertising revenue, we know about how much they care about the Gulf and all the good they're doing and how they're, making good on all their commitments.
We have just about 20 seconds. What's the follow-up to this?
Follow-up to this is to, Let's see. Right now, I mean, I do think that I will write another book. I don't know if it'll be about Washington. A number of people have asked me about Silicon Valley.
Oh, you should.
You think?
Oh, yeah.
The weather's nicer out here. yeah, I'm going to have to talk to my family first, though. I have to get back into the good graces of them after writing this book and now promoting it.
Major changes. You should definitely pursue that. Mark Leibovich is chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine and author of This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral in America's Gilded Capital. Mark, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Rose. It was great.
Nice to have you. And Mark will be speaking tonight at Kepler's in Menlo Park at 7:30. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening.